Welcome to the Model Railroader, your ultimate destination for all things railroading. From trains.com, we bring you step-by-step modeling and construction projects, insightful reviews, tips from the experts, and more. This program is proudly presented by Aftersight, a community hub for audio news, entertainment, and resources. Find us at aftersight.org. This program is intended to be used solely by individuals who are blind or have low vision. All aboard!
Thank you for joining us for the Model Railroader magazine, read by Jason Consul. Today, we will be reading the following articles: 3D print an operating signal, narrow gauge SP, and plans for a masonry depot. The first article is 3D print an operating signal. Add interest to your layout with these simple line-side details. By Colin Clues, photos by the author. Creating items for my model railroad is an aspect of the hobby that I enjoy. Recently, I decided to make operating signals for my layout using 3D printed parts and light-emitting diodes, or LEDs. The definition of a, quote, prototype signal on a model railroad varies. For some, it's the type and arrangement of aspects to best replicate the style that the prototype railroad used. For others, it's the size of the signal to fit the layout scale with sufficient detailing to make it look realistic. The options are strictly personal. Do I buy prototypical lights ready for use, or do I do my own detailing to make the signals more to my liking? This article describes the steps I went through to create working trackside signals. The LEDs. To start, we need the smallest LEDs to permit easy installation and electrical connections. There are several different types of LEDs, with the most common being through-hole and surface mount, or SMD, as shown in Figure 1. As evident in this picture, SMDs are too small for this project. The 0403 and the 1206 form factors are shown. The two leg varieties shown include 1.6mm, 1.8mm, and 2mm. If I wanted to install these in 3D printed housings, the 1.6mm LED would be difficult to mount and wire. The 1.8mm is better, but the lens projection isn't enough to penetrate through the housing. The 2mm LED was the best option for this situation. The dimensions of the 2mm LED are 0.10 by 0.14 by 0.19 inches. I found that for effective 3D printing, the sides of the housing need to be a minimum of 40 thousandths of an inch. Having determined the dimensions of the LED, I had a shell 3D printed to hold the LEDs. Creating the signal. I used a computer-aided design or CAD program to design the signal heads. After printing, the first step in the assembly was to remove any flash from the printing process. A new, sharp number 11 blade and a hobby knife easily cleans up the flash and gives us square inside corners. I also used a 3/32 inch drill and a pin vise to clean out the holes and make sure the LED could be installed without breaking. Once the corners were cleaned out, I test fit the LEDs to avoid future installation issues. The LED should be snug so they don't slip out of the housing during the wiring. To keep everything as compact as possible, I bent the legs of the LEDs at a 90-degree angle as close to the LED body as possible. After trimming the legs, I left two small lugs to which the wires would be soldered. I used 33-gauge wire for the low-current LEDs. To preserve space in the mast, I used magnet wire instead of insulated wire. The wire was prepped for soldering by melting a blob of solder on the end of the iron and inserting the end of the wire for about 2 to 3 seconds. This will burn off the varnish and tin the end of the wire. Then, the wires can be soldered to the LEDs. The LEDs were now ready to be inserted into the signal head. Make sure they're pushed in completely and that the wires are in the pocket on the side of the head. Soldering the wires may have burned off varnish further up the wire. To eliminate a short circuit, I coated the solder joints and the ends of the wires with nail polish. This is a good time to test the LEDs. The easiest way is to use a coin cell. Gather the two leads from one of the LEDs and pinch the coin battery between them. If it doesn't light up, reverse the leads. If it still doesn't turn on, check the LED connections for a short. Repeat for the other LED. Before gluing the back and enclosing the LEDs, the leads needed to be pinched together so that they can all feed into the same hole in the mast. This is why the nail polish insulation is important. With the wires pinched together, all wires will neatly fit into a single hole in the mast. Now the back can be glued to the head. I used 2mm plastic tube for the mast. I haven't been able to locate it in black, so I ended up painting the mast. After cutting the tube into 2-inch lengths, I drilled two holes using a number 64 bit. They are located 1/4 inch and 7/8 of an inch from the top. Next, I fed the wires through the mast. In this situation, I used the upper head as the red-green indicator for the main line and the lower head as the red-yellow indication for a branch line. To make the identification of the wires easier, I put a small piece of 3/64-inch heat-shrink tubing on the four wires from the first head before feeding in the wires for the second head. To glue the heads to the mast, I put a small dab of glue on the side of the head and pulled the wires so that the signal head was tight against and square to the mast. I also used small clamps to prevent the signal heads from twisting out of alignment before the glue dried. Wiring the LEDs. The next step was to identify the wires. From the previous step, there should be two groups of four wires coming from the bottom of the mast. For the upper head, I took one wire and held it to the positive of a coin cell battery. In turn, I connected each of the remaining wires to the negative. When the red LED comes on, I marked the wires as red positive and red negative. Then I repeated the process for the green LED, marking as green positive and green negative. I then connected red positive to green negative and red negative to green positive. When connected in this manner, only one LED will turn on depending on which way the battery is connected. I then repeated this procedure for the lower red-yellow signal. The signals for each head can be controlled via a double-pole, double-throw toggle switch. If a toggle is used for each head, all signal modes can be achieved, including red over red, upper signal head is red, lower signal head is red, green over red, upper signal head is green, lower signal head is red, red over yellow, upper signal head is red, lower signal head is yellow. Alternatively, both heads can be controlled by a single switch. However, this will not permit a red over red signal. My techniques produce signals suitable for HO and N scales. By increasing the LED size, signals could also be made for S, O, and G scales. These signals became the starting point for my larger project of creating a block controller for a passing sighting. In this project, I use an Arduino to sense train movements, control the turnouts, and operate the signals at both ends of the block. The project can be found by scanning the QR code on page 29. Colin Clues lives in Barrie, Ontario, Canada. This is his second article in Model Railroader. The next article is Narrow Gauge SP. This on-30 sectional layout is set in California's Owens Valley. By Dwayne Erickson. Photos by the author. In the years since dismantling my Torres and Prietis layout, featured in the April 2015 issue of Model Railroader, I've turned my attention to building an on-30 sectional layout based on Southern Pacific's narrow-gauge Keeler branch in California's Owen Valley. My interest in modeling the SP was inspired by not only the dramatic landscape that its narrow-gauge line ran through, but also my limited connection with the railroad's only narrow-gauge diesel locomotive. Around the time I built the on-30 Torres and Prietis Railroad, I was researching and writing my self-published book, Sonora Narrow Gauge, Railroads, Mines, Trams, and Scams South of the Border, 2010. During a research trip to Mexico, I was granted access to photograph former Southern Pacific General Electric 50-ton diesel No. 1. The end cab unit, affectionately known as the, quote, Little Giant, was stored behind locked gates at an industrial complex. the diesel was converted to standard gauge after it left the SP roster. During my visit, the engine was parked on a siding and in pretty rough shape, with faded paint and cracked windows. In addition to taking photos, I had a chance to sit in the engineer's seat of this piece of SP history. When Rich Yoder Models offered a brass import of this one-of-a-kind locomotive in On-30, I couldn't pass up the chance to purchase it and build an appropriate landscape to operate it in. The layout at a glance. Name, Southern Pacific Keeler Branch. Scale, On-30, or 1:48 proportion, 30-inch narrow gauge, also called On-2.5. Size, 6x17 feet. Prototype, SP narrow gauge. Locale, Owens Valley, California. Era, 1950s. Style, sectional. Mainline run, 36 feet. Minimum radius, 24 inches. Minimum turnout, number 5. Maximum grade, none. Benchwork, open grid. Height, 50 inches. Roadbed, 1x4 clear pine. Track, Micro Engineering Code 83. Scenery, sifted, demagnetized soil. Backdrop, none. Control, direct current, Model Rectifier Corporation Tech 6. Inset into the main article is a smaller article titled Tips for Photographing Models Outdoors. Photographing outdoors can be both rewarding and humbling. When successful, nothing compares to the quality of natural light and the way it reacts to a well-crafted scene. Even Hollywood, with its lighting experts and almost unlimited budgets, can't recreate the feel of sunlight in its studios. On the other hand, placing models next to the real thing can be humbling. Often what looks acceptable on the workbench looks toy-like when directly compared to a real structure or landscape. Based on mistakes I've made over the years, here are a few tips to help you the next time you photograph your models outdoors. When planning your layout, leave a generous foreground between the edge of the layout and track. In O-scale, I try to leave about a foot. Without ample foreground, it's difficult to get realistic photographs. When possible, design visual breaks at the edge of the layout or section to separate it from the background. The transition between the model and real thing is one of the most challenging parts of photographing outdoors. Matching the color of the rocks, soil, and vegetation presents another challenge. I often refer to photographs or Google Earth to match the colors. However, even in the desert, colors change throughout the seasons. Natural light tends to filter through trees, shrubs, and grass. Traditional modeling standbys like ground foam aren't translucent and will appear unrealistic under natural light. Metal and wood models photograph better in sunlight than plastic. Even well-painted plastic can have an unnatural shine in direct light. Place the sections atop tall sawhorses on high ground to photograph them. This will help with the background perspective. Place the camera as low as practical. Watch the weather, particularly wind forecasts. A breeze of only 10 miles per hour will knock over small details. Stronger wind can derail trains. Now back to the main article. Switching to sectional. My Torres and Prietas was an island-style layout built in half of our two-car garage. I constructed the model railroad on wheels so I could photograph it outdoors. Though I wanted to take pictures of the Keeler Branch outdoors, I took a different approach and built my new layout in sections. Each lightweight section uses open-grid benchwork, 1x4 pine, covered with 2-inch thick extruded foam insulation board. I originally intended to build the layout to Pacific Northwest On-30 modular standards. However, I chose sections instead as they better fit each scene. The Keeler, California side of the layout is made up of a pair of 2-foot 6-inch by 6-foot sections. Across from that are a set of 2-foot by 6-foot sections. The side opposite Keeler represents the narrow gauge line as it crosses the desert floor, with a single spur serving a corral. The end sections, which I've yet to finish, measure 2 feet 6 inches by 6 feet and serve as return loops. I attached the Micro Engineering Code 83 track to 1x4 clear pine roadbed. The 24-inch radius curves and number 5 turnouts are sufficient for the short wheelbase narrow gauge models. The layout height is 50 inches throughout, so there are no grades. Scenery and structures. I scenicked the sections with a naturally occurring form of calcium carbonate, chalk, from an abandoned mine in California. The material closely matches the alkali flats and sand dunes found along the southern end of the full-size SP narrow gauge. Prior to applying the calcium carbonate, I passed magnets over it to remove any metallic elements. Modeling even a tiny hamlet like Keeler, California, or a population of 71, involves compromise. Though the three-track yard reasonably represents the prototype, the structures required a fair amount of selective compression. The two large structures at Keeler, Sierra Talc, and the Southern Pacific Station were reduced to approximately half the footprint of the full-size buildings by focusing on the character-defining features. I built the structures by applying weathered basswood over a sturdy base. Then I added San Juan Detail's injection-molded plastic parts to the buildings. As a hobby within the hobby, I enjoy building architectural models. I currently have shelves of them that lack a permanent place on the layout. Some of these structures appear in the photographs accompanying this article, but aren't depicted on the track plan, such as the station at Kearsarge, California. The structures and rolling stock are weathered to reflect exposure to the wind-swept, sun-baked environment of the Owens Valley. Some of my techniques include chalks and spray paint. I also enjoy the challenge of finding out-of-the-box solutions for modeling. For example, I used aluminum cans for most corrugated metal and standing seam roofs, and pillow fiber tufts for the desert brush. The asphalt-covered streets in Keeler are Bondo, a filler used in auto body repair, coated with flat spray paint. Thanks for the inspiration. Like many of us, I remember waiting for the latest issues of Model Railroader, Trains, and other magazines to reach the local hobby shop. With each issue, we were treated to the work of talented modelers and photographers like Bob Hayden and the late Malcolm Furlow. The stark desert landscape of my On30 SP Keeler branch doesn't resemble the down east Maine coast woodlands of Bob's Cara Bassett and Dead River or the Colorado Rockies of Malcolm's San Juan Central. But to this day, I'm still influenced by the way both men captured the feel of the scenes without relying on computer programs to enhance their modeling efforts. As a tip of the hat to those who inspired me, I traveled to the Owens Valley with three of my six SP narrow gauge sections and photographed them in natural light. It was my hope to capture the layout with images taken as though I'd stumbled upon the operation before abandonment in 1960. Meet Dwayne Erickson. Dwayne Erickson is a historical archaeologist with the Bureau of Land Management's Abandoned Mining Lands Program. Though stationed out of Medford, Oregon, he has recorded and preserved historic landscapes, mines, ghost towns, and architecture throughout the American West. He credits much of his early interest in history and railroads to Trains and Model Railroader during the 1970s. He has published two books on narrow gauge mining railroads and is currently writing a third on mining camp architecture. Dwayne has been married to his wife Gretchen for more than 20 years. Together, they have three children and three grandchildren. The next article is Plans for a Masonry Depot. This Lehigh Valley structure is located in Gorham, New York, by Harold W. Russell, photos and illustrations by the author. The Naples branch of the Lehigh Valley ran southwest from Geneva to Naples, New York, and the central part of the state. Along the way, the railroad passed through many small communities, each with a wood depot. The exception was Gorham, which was home to an elaborate concrete block and stucco structure. The depot's flowing lines and glass patterns surrounding the canopies make it an interesting modeling subject. Prototype history. In the middle of the 19th century, the area between Geneva and Naples was noted for its nurseries, foundries, and glass and brick foundries. Later, Naples gained fame for its wineries. The shores of the nearby Finger Lakes have an ideal climate for grape growing. At the time, the market for these businesses were primarily local since the area lacked good transportation. The residents of the Naples Valley saw Geneva, their rail-served neighbor to the north, as a gateway for their products. In 1871, the 29-mile Geneva and Southern Railway was chartered. The proposed line would connect Naples, Middlesex, Valley View, Rushville, Gorham, and Stanley to Geneva, joining the Lehigh Valley west of its depot. The villages along the line were bonded for the railroad's construction. By 1872, the route was surveyed, grading commenced, and some bridges were built. But the financial panic of 1873 brought all work to a halt. The bonded villages lost their money. In 1892, the Middlesex Valley Railroad was incorporated, with its construction using the graded right-of-way of the Geneva and Southwestern. The railroad was finished in 1894. The Lehigh Valley acquired it a year later when it purchased all the railroad's capital stock. The line then became known as the Naples branch of the Lehigh Valley. Fancy in a no-frills era. When the Middlesex Valley Railroad built its depots, each community was offered a standard, no-frills, single-floor wood building. Photographs show that Stanley, Rushville, and Middlesex chose this option. Naples, the largest community on the branch line, built a two-story wood depot. Both the Naples and Rushville's depots were distinguished by gingerbread at their roof peaks. Gorham was the exception. Its leadership, viewing the town as an up-and-coming community, chose to build a formidable concrete block and stucco structure that would be indicative of the community's wealth and well-being. Because of Gorham's wisdom, this passenger depot is the only one on the Naples branch still in existence. The Naples Freight House still exists by taking turns as a business and residence. Making the plans. The drawings of the Gorham Depot were made by measuring the full-size structure. The building is a combination passenger/baggage or freight design. The freight portion has an elevated floor to match the height of the concrete platform. There's no platform on the track side. Presumably, the height of baggage carts was equal to this floor height. A short stairway connected the freight and baggage room with the office. The structure's trackside and roadside walls are mirror images of each other. Rather ornate and elegant canopies covered the two entrances to the passenger section of the depot. The gingerbread trim that surrounds the canopy was filled with tinted glass. When I visited, the depot was heavily overgrown and some of the stucco was spalling off the walls. The tracks were removed years ago. The inside of the passenger section was inaccessible, so the floor plan is speculative. We were able to stick a camera inside the freight section. An LV 1911 site map shows the development of the area surrounding the Gorham Depot. It had several industries including a warehouse, meatpacking plant, and fertilizer company. Modeling considerations. A model of the Gorham Depot would be a distinctive addition to your model railroad. The ornate gingerbread could be best modeled with photo etching. Brick materials are available from various manufacturers. When I last visited, the building was weathered white stucco with red bricks. To read more on the Naples branch, see Upstate Odyssey, the Lehigh Valley Railroad in Western New York by Mary Hamilton Dan. Railroad Research Publications, 1997. Though the book is out of print, copies are still available through used book dealers. Harold W. Russell's illustrations have been appearing in Model Railroader magazine since the mid-1960s. He has more than 150 bylines to his credit. Thank you for joining us for Model Railroader magazine, read by Jason Consul.
You've been listening to the Model Railroader brought to you by Trains.com. That's TRANES.com. In collaboration with AfterSight. If you've enjoyed this episode, we invite you to visit our website at AfterSight.org for more audio editions and original podcasts. For additional inquiries or to contact us, call us at 303-786-7777 or email contact@AfterSight.org. Thank you for listening. Thank you.